between what has gone before and what is coming. And the title of this canto is The House of the Spirit and the New Creation. What Asvapati experiences, what is described in the second section, which we read, is the house of the spirit and what he experiences there. And the third section will tell about the third and the fourth will tell about the new creation. And then we shall see what comes next. So let's have a look first at this movement of transition from that powerful vision that, and experience of the presence of the Transcendent Mother, the Supreme Divine Mother, that Asvapati has had in Canto 2, which has given him a sense of mission. Now what comes next? So we'll go back to page 317. Don, you will start, please.
Canto 3, in the house of the spirit and the new creation.
I think these two sentences are not very difficult to understand. No, the language is very clear. What is unusual is in line 3, this usage of the word attending. It means waiting for. Sri Aurobindo is using it in the French sense, attendre, to wait for or expect something. So he's waiting for, hoping for, aspiring for a sign from that higher secret consciousness which knows the truth, ungrasped behind our thoughts. And it's that higher consciousness which is guarding, protecting the world with its all-seeing gaze. And then there's this beautiful picture of Asvapati himself. Sitting in meditation, in concentration, as if he's just a hope made into a body. No, he's only that. There's no other movement in his being. He's intense, one-pointed, monumental. There's something very, very powerful about him. He's all alone, motionless, on a pedestal of prayer. A pedestal is the base for a statue. So that's what he's, on a solid base, a marble seat of concentration. Yes, Don.
You just explained a sign attending from the secrecy, but attending also has another meaning, which I felt also fits taking care of and attending.
Yes, you can have that also in the back of your mind, but I think the main meaning is this: he's waiting for that sign, and it doesn't come immediately. So he has a mightier task than all he had done. He has done so much, but still something much more he has to do. And for that he needs a strength that was not yet on earth. Something that has not yet manifested, a new power. He needs help from a power that is far, far greater than mortal will. His human will can't command that power. He needs the light of that truth which he has glimpsed, but which he's only seen at a distance. And he, above all, he's waiting for a sanction. In this case, a sanction that says, yes. He needs a yes from his high, omnipotent source, the source of his whole existence and consciousness and force. He needs that sanction that says yes. But it doesn't come. The timeless lids, the eyelids, now of eternity, are closed. No opening came. There's no one looking down and responding to his prayer. So he feels this helpless emptiness, this without any qualities, neutral, oppressing, weighing down on the years, making the passage of time seem heavy and meaningless. And he becomes very much aware in the texture of our bound humanity. Texture is the substance, the fabric, in the very make of our human nature, there's a resistance, a huge resistance. With no softening in it. It is stark. It doesn't say anything, but it just resists. That is the resistance of our base, the inconscience, the lack of vision and understanding, which is the very base of our life, of our consciousness. Which in life turns into a stubborn rejection, firmly saying, no, I don't want it. No. This is the ignorant no, which is there in the very origin of things, with its roots deep in the inconscient. That is what makes the transformation so difficult. We can notice this in ourselves. Whatever aspiration we may have in our hearts and minds and soul and spirit, there's something dragging us down and refusing to respond and refusing to change. Shall we go on, Franz? Anything to ask?
No. Gracious imperfections seems to be.
You have to think of some examples, some of the things that we know they are imperfect, but we don't want to give them up. We are kind of affectionate towards them.
What it means? Gracious, the imperfections are gracious. They have some beauty or some.
There's some power of attraction to them. Yes. And we there's that element in us which would like to say to God, oh, but surely I don't need to change this. No, it's nothing after all. It's so sweet. The sweet weaknesses of our mortal state. After all, it's only human. Why has this got to change? Yeah, there might be some higher ideals. He says old ideal voices, no? So there are things that maybe have helped us to progress in the past, some limited kinds of truths or some idea about love or, things like this that have helped us in our past progress. But now it's time to get rid of them, but we still cling on. We treasure them in a old world frame, as the idea of an old painting that we love very much. But it's out of place and time now for this mightier task that he has to do. This has to go. It's in the way, it's no longer appropriate. Yes, Sergei.
Leniency.
Yes. If you've, a little boy has done something very bad, you might feel like being lenient to him, not punishing him really the way that what he's done might deserve, but being gentle, being lenient, not too strict. Yeah. Also finding excuses. Yes, but it's asking for a heavenly leniency. It's asking for God to be gentle to us, to allow our little weaknesses to be glossed over and forgiven. No?
That's a description of all of it.
So all of these
there's something like that, yes.
So all of these together are the element in him betraying God?
Yes. Yes. Well, that comes from this shadowy unity with a vanished past, this identification with something that maybe in the past, in its place, had a use and a value, but now it's out of place. No? So that clinging to that past state, that's the element in him. That's betraying God, that's in subconscious whispers and in dreams. It's still complaining, it's murmuring and protesting at the choice of the mind and the spirit. It's not very, very conscious. This is an underground movement that is objecting.
I think in the news and also the mother's agenda page, the mother's writing about love, divine love and human love, and there I think it comes very clear that it is good for a time to love with this, but then go to this divine love which embracing all.
Yes, there are many such elements in us. Even our morality, our sense of what is good and correct and right, there comes a stage in our spiritual development where we have to open up and be more open to a direct divine guidance instead of just that ethical way of looking at things, that oh, this is right and that is wrong.
One more question. This element betraying God, it will be in us until the whole transformation.
Well, we'll see what Asvapati has to do to get rid of it. Yeah. But it's definitely what needs to be transformed. No? But what is going to transform? So the first thing he does is to look, where is it and what is it? To be ruthlessly searching every part of his being. to find where all that element is rooted. A ruthless self-examination. So he searches with fire, with the fire of aspiration and of will. He searches all these recondite spaces, these hidden nooks and crannies and corners, strips everything bare, searches all those dim crypts, underground cellars and corners with this white fire, heaven's cleansing flame. He's got a kind of a flamethrower to purify everything. All those places where the old instincts, they are refugees, they are running away from his search, from his will, but he's determined to find them. And those unshaped revolts, they haven't really taken form, but there's that complaining and unwillingness to accept, to surrender. He's looking wherever they could possibly find some hiding place in the darkness. So when he's done that, everything seems to have perished that was undivine, but he wants to be absolutely sure that no tiniest little dissident, a dissident is somebody who disagrees, with the ruling power, he protests. He doesn't want even the tiniest little dissident to escape, because that tiny little dissident could, if it remains hiding there, it could be a center from which that blind force, that ignorant no, can spread. And all this is there in the subconscious, in the inconscient. And he becomes aware so clearly that the inconscient is also infinite. The more we insist on finding the bottom in the deepest places, the more it stretches endlessly. This is the problem. So it's going to go on stretching. So what is he going to do? What he has to do is what comes next. You like to read, Mom?
Then let the human cry choose for you.
So this is a very radical and violent movement, so that no human cry can spoil this higher truth. He has to tear desire up from its bleeding roots. He has to eradicate it completely in himself. And Sri Aurobindo makes it sound like pulling your own tooth out. And then that empty space where the desire had been, he can offer to the higher powers, to the gods. And in thus this way, he becomes able to bear this immaculate touch, the touch that is absolutely pure. And this brings about a last and mightiest transformation. Yes, Mila.
This whole section could be interpreted, I don't know if I'm getting the clear picture, like he's trying to clean himself completely inside.
Yes.
All this is looking inside. But as deeper he goes to finding all the spaces of the darkness, because darkness is growing.
It doesn't grow, he becomes aware that there's no end to it.
Yeah. So it's immense.
It's like it's an infinite ocean of darkness.
Yes. Yeah. So then he kind of takes out all the desire of changing, of finding even our clearness itself.
Here I think it means desire really in the spiritual sense.
Yes, the desire of cleaning himself, because he's trying to clean all the spaces, and it seems it's growing, or is like you say, infinite. So he, at one point,
he finds that he can't clean all that up. So what he has to do is to cut the connection in himself to all that darkness. And the connection is these things at the roots of life, these desires, these instincts, these revolts. And he just has to find a way to tear that out of himself.
But these desires are not also related to the desires are not also related here to the impulses to clean himself also.
Well, that is his aspiration. I don't think we should think of aspiration here as a form of desire. Because aspiration is actually the process, no, that's going to purify. This, what he's doing now is the rejection. He's saying, no, this desire must go. Whatever it takes. And if any of us want to follow this process, we have to find our own way to do it. But here, what strikes me is the way that Sri Aurobindo makes it a really heroic act, which requires a tremendous amount of will, courage, endurance, readiness to face pain, you know, the pain of tearing up something that's actually fundamental in our human nature. Yes.
He has mentioned that what kind of instinct and desires like he had, and that he pull out all those things.
Here he hasn't mentioned, no, he's just said it in a general way.
I think what is for me interesting is also this point. And offer to the God to make a place.
Well, first you have to make the place vacant.
Vacant, yes.
Then you can offer it to the higher power.
Just be conscious of it, that it's there, and experience it, and then you can offer it.
Mm-hmm. There has to be an active will for purity, and that has to be actually worked out in action. Then you have to resist everything that those refugee instincts and revolts suggest to you. Well, that's what happens here. When there's a sufficient degree of purification, then, and of course you must recognize this is the last of a series of transformations that have been going on. The first one comes in Canto 3 of Book 1 with the release of the soul when he's liberated by the wisdom, by the consciousness. And there we're told about the first transformation of his body, affects even his body. And then there's a second transformation which comes in Canto 5 of Book 1, where as a result of his intense aspiration for a diviner life, and he's shown taking off like a rocket in that upward movement, and in response there comes a very, very powerful descent of transforming force which gets hold of his whole nature and changes it. And as a result of that, he has this access to and a certain degree of mastery in the subtle worlds, which enables him to start on this journey as the traveler of the worlds. And there, when he's traveling through the worlds and he comes to the world of life, he first of all sees on the subtle dimensions what our life is like and where it has come from. But he also becomes aware that there's a divine life, higher levels of life, and that he can't enter them. There's something in his own nature which is preventing him from entering those pure worlds of divine life. And then he does that great descent into the night. And there he comes to a kind of bottom, the last locked subconscious floor. And there he finds a golden secret, the key to nature's change. And he experiences a wonderful liberation which throws him immediately into the paradise of the life gods. So the way I understand this is the complete purification and liberation of the life being in him individually. This is not a transformation for the whole world, it's for him. But it enables him to go further on his journey. And he comes to the self of mind, and there again he feels a complete blockage. Seems impossible to go any further. And then he's invited to enter the world of soul. And there he experiences the Divine Mother, the Universal Mother. And he falls unconscious, prone. And when he becomes conscious again, he is in the kingdoms of the greater knowledge. So this is also a kind of transformation of consciousness. And then he has come here into book 3, and he's seen the mother and understood who she is, and he's dedicated himself to for the redemption of the earth and men. That came in Canto 2. We saw this phrase for the first time. That it's not only that he wants a diviner life for himself and that possibility on earth. He wants really that transformation for earth. And that's this mightiest task that he has to do now. And how is he going to do it? And in order to do it, he has to transform in his individual being all these resistances. And then comes this last and mightiest transformation. And then his soul comes all in front like a great sea. And all sense of separate self is lost. He feels one with the whole universe. And then he's able to experience the house of the spirit, and later on to see the new creation. He's given a vision of what the world will be like when this transformation comes about in general. So his being spread to embrace the whole universe, because the soul, which is always one with the divine, came forward into the whole nature, flooded the mind and the body with its waves, so his whole being can open to embrace the universe. And he makes what is within and what is outside into a a universal harmony which is ruled by the indwelling divine, the divine dwelling within.
All nature felt again as in the bliss.
Thank you. Well, we can read the next two lines. Please read the next two lines, Bridget.
There was no cleavage between soul and soul. There was no barrier between world and God.
Thank you. This means feeling the oneness not only in some high blissful state, but really one with the world and with all the suffering and pain and imperfection that's in the world. This can only happen when we are really in touch with the one, when soul bears everything for us. There's a couple of poems, a sonnet and then another short poem from the late 1930s, when Sri Aurobindo writes about this feeling of oneness in the flesh and the nerve with everything that's going on in the earth, feeling the bombs bursting on the Barcelona streets and in Canton, and feeling the, he uses the same line in both poems. He says he bears the sorrow of millions in my single breast. That's only possible when there's no barrier between world and God. He says the earth is like that in a way. The earth is holding up all this effort of sacrifice that's going on. And the earth goddess can do that because she feels the presence, the joy and the peace of the transcendent within her, penetrating her.
What is this barrier between world and God?
Well, for us, matter is the barrier, no? But I suppose the barrier really is our own consciousness. We are so self-centered that we don't experience that the Lord is everywhere and in everything, that he's filling all this, that it's only the Lord that we breathe in and breathe out, and all the food that we take is just the Lord, and everything that touches us is only the Lord. We don't experience it like that normally.
Here, this is the last realization of the
of Asvapati. It says this is a last and mightiest transformation of Asvapati.
Also, that he, like a human being, also last stage of the transformation. This is the pain.
Yes, we can say the last fulfillment of evolution will be when we can all join this experience, when this experience becomes conscious not only in human beings, but in the matter itself. So I think we'll stop there for today.